Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
So far, for every social media threat we've ever had, students have gone to school, continued to stay in school.
The Anchorage School District prioritizes security upgrades after Tuesday's school shooting in Texas. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, where candidates in the special election for U.S. House stand on abortion.
Lots and lots and lots of emails and texts. And all asking the same question, and I gave them all the same answer.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
Representatives of the Anchorage School District say increasing security at school entrances is a high priority after a high school student in Uvalde, Texas, killed 19 students and 2 teachers at an elementary school on Tuesday. Anchorage began adding secure vestibules to its elementary schools 4 years ago. They add additional levels of security at school entrances by requiring visitors to enter through 2 locked doors. Front office staff can see people outside the front door at all times, either through windows or security cameras. The district has built secure vestibules at 17 of 61 elementary schools so far.
We won't stop until we've done all of our elementary schools.
Rob Holland is the senior director of maintenance and operations for the district. He says he's hopeful the budget the legislature passed earlier this month could free up some funds for district security projects.
As soon as we know that, then we will move swiftly to complete as many of these as we can with that money, if approved, in Juneau. And that way we won't have to wait till next April, and we'll be able to put even more of these on the next bond.
A $111 million bond on the Anchorage municipal ballot would have paid for new secure vestibules at 12 schools. That bond failed, but the school board could put another bond on the ballot next year. In the meantime, the district has other security measures in place. Ashley Lally is the district's director of security and emergency preparedness. She says the district works closely with school resource officers and the Anchorage Police Department. The district notifies police about social media threats, and the department calls nearby schools if someone in the area is considered armed and dangerous.
So far, for every social media threat we've ever had, students have gone to school, continued to stay in school. And I think a lot of that is because of our strong partnership with our school resource officers. They act very fast and efficiently, and that helps us to be able to make really good decisions.
Lally says the district's health services department is also working to expand mental health resources at every school. A leaked opinion from the Supreme Court shows it is likely to overturn the landmark abortion decision Roe v. Wade. Abortion advocates are calling on Congress to act, and with the special election for U.S. House underway in Alaska, abortion has become a hot-button political issue this election season. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin is here to discuss where the candidates stand on the issue. Liz, remind us, why is this a question for the Congress?
Well, it's not necessarily, but Roe established a right to abortion. If Roe falls, states will be able to ban the procedure unless Congress passes a law mandating that abortion be legal nationwide. So that's why it's a question for Congress and why you hear lawmakers and candidates talk about codifying Roe, meaning putting abortion rights in U.S. code.
Okay, so we've got 48 candidates in this special election for U.S. House. I imagine their views are all over the place.
Yes, and we know that a lot of voters do look to where a candidate stands on abortion to make their decision. Nonpartisan candidate and Gardner Jeff Lowenfels says he's had more questions about abortion than any other topic.
Lots and less and less of emails and texts. And all asking the same question, and I gave them all the same answer, and it's none of the government's business whatsoever. It's entirely up to the woman, and I support Roe v. Wade. I think I'd probably change that answer a little bit after the shooting last night.
He's referring to the school shooting in Texas there.
Yeah, Lowenfels is linking more restrictive gun laws to the abortion issue.
As far as I'm concerned, gun control is my right to life.
What Lowenfels means is if you care about life, you should pass laws to prevent mass shootings rather than blocking access to abortion. And at the other end of the spectrum, we've got several candidates like John Coghill who oppose abortion in nearly all circumstances. Coghill says human life begins at conception and doesn't think abortion should be legal even when pregnancy results from rape. The only exception Coghill supports is if the abortion would save a woman's life.
There are some really, really sad circumstances that people have to deal with at the hospital. And at that point, it really should be between a good healthcare provider and that woman. And so that's where me and the pro-life crowd part company, probably.
Well, we've got 46 other candidates. How do we sort through them?
Yeah, on the abortion rights side, we've got, among others, all the registered Democrats. That is Chris Constant, Mike Milligan, Mary Peltola, Ernest Thomas, Adam Wohl, and Emil Noddy. Noddy is interesting. He says he's in favor of states' rights, so that would preclude Roe. But Noddy says on a state level, he thinks abortion should be legal.
Interesting, but some of the Republicans and nonpartisans also favor abortion rights, correct?
Yeah, a lot of the nonpartisans, including Al Gross and Santa Claus, say women should have access to legal abortion. And among Republicans, a few support abortion rights. For instance, Tara Sweeney says the federal government shouldn't have a role in women's health care decisions. While I support a woman's right to choose, Sweeney says I oppose late-term abortions except in cases where a woman's life or health is in jeopardy.
That leaves a lot of Republicans in this U.S. House race, what, in favor of making abortion illegal?
Well, some didn't answer our survey questions. Some answered with responses that are hard to categorize. I can tell you that two of the prominent Republicans, Sarah Palin and Nick Begich, both identify themselves as pro-life, meaning against abortion rights.
Liz, didn't the U.S. House already pass a bill to codify Roe, but just this month the Senate's version was blocked? So how likely is this to come up again in this short term to fill out Don Young's term? Like, what is it, until January?
Yeah, it's possible this would still be an issue in this term of Congress if, for instance, the Senate passed a less comprehensive abortion rights bill than the House version, and then the House would have to approve it. But this isn't likely to occur because, it's really hard to find compromise on anything, but especially abortion.
Yeah, gotcha. All right. Well, that was Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin discussing the views on abortion held by some of the 48 candidates in the special election for the U.S. House seat. Liz, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Sitka resident behind the musical skills of one SpongeBob SquarePants character.
We said, we have a character on SpongeBob who plays a clarinet. Would you be interested in covering that part? I said, sure.
And he did. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. NEA Alaska members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org and help NEA Alaska reach, teach, and inspire all Alaska students. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Warm and dry weather heading into Memorial Day weekend has prompted warnings for Alaskans to be extra careful not to start wildfires. A burn ban is in effect in Anchorage, prohibiting campfires, outdoor fire pits, and other open burning, though barbecue grills, including those using charcoal, are still allowed. Violating a city burn ban is now a misdemeanor crime under an emergency ordinance the Anchorage Assembly passed Tuesday. Burn permits are suspended for most of South Central Alaska, including the Matanuska and Susitna Valleys and the Kenai Peninsula, as well as Fairbanks, Delta Junction, and the Copper River Basin. And the National Weather Service has issued red flag warnings for a swath covering all of the central interior and most of South Central and Southwest Alaska. Those areas are expected to see sunny skies and high temperatures in the 60s or 70s through the holiday weekend. The Weather Service says rapid ignition, growth, and spread of fires will be possible. And quick action last night halted another early season wildfire in Fairbanks. Alaska Division of Forestry Information Officer Sam Harrell says firefighters responded to a 911 call after 6 p.m. about a blaze in a residential area.
Showed up on scene and a resident was outside his home frantically trying to put out a grass fire, but it was already gone and into the trees and away from him.
Harrell says firefighters on the ground, aided by two helicopters dropping buckets of water on the flames, stopped the main fire and two spot fires at a total of about 1 acre.
They've got saw line all the way around it. The perimeter is cold.
Harrell says no structures were damaged by the fire, which had a very unusual source of ignition.
Turns out that he was working on a do-it-yourself electric bike that he was building. And the batteries failed, caused a short, sparks flew into the dry grass.
Harrell calls the fire a simple accident and says the man is not being cited. He says the incident shows how easily a wildfire can start in warm, dry, and windy conditions. A plan to upgrade electrical transmission lines from Fairbanks to Homer could pave the way for more renewable energy transmission on the rail belt. That's according to Curtis Thayer. He's executive director of the Alaska Energy Authority, a public corporation of the state. And his corporation and five rail belt utilities has announced they're embarking on $200 million worth of upgrades to existing transmission lines.
This is probably the largest infrastructure upgrade in 30 years on the rail belt, and for all the utilities to be united, and again, it not costing ratepayers additional money and not costing the state treasury, that's a win-win.
Transmission lines carry electricity from one point to another on an electrical grid. Thayer says most lines on the rail belt are owned by the Energy Authority, others are owned by the utilities themselves. And they're all getting old. Many have not been updated in decades. That's a problem in part because aging transmission lines can lead to blackouts. Thayer says it's also important that transmission lines are in good shape as momentum for renewable energy projects in South Central grows. Take the proposed plan to build a 60,000-panel solar farm in Sterling.
Today, we cannot transport that power to Anchorage or Matsu or to Fairbanks because the transmission capacity is not there. So we have to upgrade our transmission lines, and this is the first step in doing it.
The project will be funded by the utility's excess bond payments for the Bradley Lake project. That's the 120-megawatt hydropower project on the other side of Kachemak Bay from Fritz Creek. The utilities finished paying off the bonds for that project last year. The project supplies power to all the rail belt's utilities, and it's poised now to expand as the Dixon Glacier nearby recedes and releases more water to be harnessed. Thayer says it's another project that stands to benefit from better transmission infrastructure. Well, when a fire ripped through Tununuk's Washateria in February, it left folks without an easy place to wash clothes. But the fire also damaged the community's internet infrastructure, causing outages for half of the village. Not having internet has made it difficult for people to accomplish regular everyday tasks, like sending emails, uploading documents, or ordering necessities online. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
Tununuk resident Alvina Whitman started a new job in March as an Indian Child Welfare Act worker.
I don't have internet access or email access, and because of that, I'm missing out. I feel like I'm missing out on a lot.
Whitman says she's missed important meetings and trainings for her new job, and it's impacted the children she's working to protect. She's missed out on Office of Children's Services hearings, where decisions are made about whether a child should be removed from the care of their guardians. She says because of the outages, she can only find out about the hearings through the mail. Whitman has not only lost internet in her office, she's lost it in her home too. She's still able to use internet on her phone, but says service is spotty and slow. She says that makes it more difficult for her to order necessities online.
Sometimes I forget to order. Sometimes I end up not ordering because the internet's so slow.
Once she wasn't able to order diapers for her baby. She ran out and ended up having to buy a pack from Bethel, which was around $60 more expensive than online. According to GCI, the internet outage has impacted 5 businesses and 12 homes in Tununic. But Tununic's tribal administrator, Xavier Post, says it's actually affected around 45 homes. That's more than half the community. The internet is also out in the tribal office. It's making Xavier Post's job a lot harder. He spends a lot of time using the internet to file financial reports and apply for grants. He says the tribe has possibly missed grant deadlines.
It's delaying our reports. It's very frustrating. And the internet we have right now, it takes up most of our day.
Each task takes him double or triple the usual amount of time. He gets around not having internet at work by texting photos of the tribe's financial documents to a consultant in Fairbanks, or by lugging his work computers home and using his personal internet. GCI spokesperson Heather Handyside says she gets where Post is coming from.
Yeah, I definitely can understand why folks are frustrated. I know that connectivity is, you know, a need. It's not a nice to have, it's a must have.
Handyside said the company is working to restore the internet. She said workers could be in Tununic by the end of the week. But Tribal Administrator Xavier Post said GCI has been telling them they'll get there by the end of the week since February. Handyside said the company had been waiting for a cable to arrive for months. Now they're waiting on specialty technicians to install it. She said both slowdowns are caused by general supply chain issues and an increased demand for broadband.
Unfortunately, a big piece of this, which is, you know, some key equipment that we needed, it was just out of our hands.
Handyside said the residents without internet have not been charged during this time period. In addition to waiting on internet, Tununic is also still waiting on a temporary washateria from the state of Alaska. Internet outages have made communications with the state slow. Tribal Administrator Xavier Post said that's delayed the process of getting the washateria, but he still hopes they'll have it at some point this summer. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The special primary election for U.S. Representative is June 11th. Voters will automatically receive a ballot in the mail starting April 27th. No regular polling places will be open on Election Day. You will vote for only one candidate, and you must return your ballot by June 11th with your signature, identifier, and a witness signature. If you will not be at your current mailing address or do not receive a ballot, contact the Division of Elections. You can vote in person at the Division's regional offices beginning May 27th. Offices will be open on weekdays between 8 and 5, on weekends with limited hours, and on Election Day between 7 and 8. For the full schedule and a list of additional in-person voting locations, visit the Division's website at akvoteearly.alaska.gov. For assistance in Alaska Native languages, please call 1-866-954-8683. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Elections.
Since the 1980s, the state of Alaska has been the landlord to the residents of a few historic homes in downtown Juneau. With the city's help, the state bought and took the properties in hopes of someday building a new capital complex there. And now there's a renewed push to let the city redevelop the area. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
On a sunny afternoon, Maureen Connerton lounges in a camp chair with her husband outside the home they lease on Telephone Hill. It's a prominent knob of land in the middle of downtown Juneau that juts out toward Gastineau Channel. There's a plaque on the door that claims it's Juneau's oldest home, built in the early 1880s. She reminisces about epic Alaska folk festival after parties that the neighborhood hosted in the 90s.
It was wild. We had to take everything off the walls, everything. Moved the furniture into this side room back there because there were so many people.
She says one year, the festival's headliner played harmonica, you know, like in the pantry.
The walk-in pantry. It was just like, wow, this is so amazing.
Those after parties are long gone. And according to a 1984 agreement between the city and the state, her home and six others on Telephone Hill are also supposed to be long gone to make way for a new Capitol complex. The state had 10 years to redevelop the land. By 1994, the state was supposed to compensate the city with cash and land. That didn't happen. 2019, the state listed Telephone Hill in the report as an asset it should consider selling, and the city of Juneau indicated that it wanted it. Last week, the Alaska legislature passed a bill that nudges the state to get on with it. It was 11 p.m. on the Alaska legislature's final night in session, literally the 11th hour, when Juneau Senator Jesse Keel got an amendment through that directs the administration to transfer Telephone Hill to the city.
Since, you know, we just a few years back put, oh, I think it was $37 million into seismic and other upgrades of the state capitol building, it seems pretty clear that we're not pursuing a new state capitol building anywhere in the next generation or so.
The bill, with Keel's amendment, is bound for the governor's desk for his signature.
I believe that this land transfer would have happened eventually. I think this just cut some time and some uncertainty out of the process.
Connerton says uncertainty is ingrained into life on Telephone Hill. Over the decades, it's discouraged the residents from investing in significant repair projects, things like roof replacements and fresh paint. She says it feels like every time they're ready to, there are new rumblings that they'll finally be put out of their homes.
Where they've said, you know, this is the end, we're going to do something, and then they don't. We've been lucky that way because it's a great place. And everybody, you know, we get along. It's a real neighborhood.
Ironically, the less than ideal condition of the homes is one reason the city and state say it's ripe for redevelopment. For now, city officials are waiting for the governor's signature on the bill. After that, the Juneau Assembly will have some decisions to make about what to do with Telephone Hill. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Although the show SpongeBob SquarePants was carefully targeted at a cartoon-loving demographic in the 1990s, parts of the delightfully offbeat production were a happy accident. Namely, SpongeBob's jazzophile neighbor Squidward and his somewhat random clarinet performances. As KCAW's Catherine Rose reports, the musical genius of Squidward can be traced back to one person who now lives in Sitka and shares his gifts every week on his own radio program.
Brad Caro grew up in Los Angeles.
And I was a Valley kid, raised in the San Fernando Valley. My father worked in the film industry. He was a sound effects man. He had a friend who got me a job as the driver for an animation company. And after a month, they liked me, and they got me into the editor's union, and I was an apprentice sound effects editor.
He was working on cartoons like Heathcliff, and soon he made the move to Universal Studios and then Warner Brothers.
It was a magical time being on the lot in the 80s because the real icons of film were still around, and you could see them, you know, and meet them.
He'd see people like Ernest Borgnine walking around the lot and Anthony Perkins, who was directing Psycho 3 at the time. One day, he helped Jimmy Stewart find his way to Stage 4. And he met a few animation legends in the 80s, too.
And I got to meet Mel Blanc. He was the voice of Bugs Bunny, in case you don't know. And he was a really, really nice man. Of course, he was a dirty old man. He had a watch that had a naked lady on it. But he was a cool cat.
It took about 10 years for Caro to go from assistant to associate film editor and then finally to full-fledged film editor. Eventually, he ended up at Nickelodeon Studios. And one day, he found himself editing the pilot for a new show about a yellow kitchen sponge that would end up rocking the world of children's television from a pineapple under the sea. That's right, SpongeBob SquarePants. Caro was asked by the creator, the late Steven Hillenburg, to write a song for the show that sounded like the theme to the 60s show, The Mod Squad.
So I went ahead and wrote something and recorded in the studio with all real. I played five different sax parts. I had a trumpet player who covered four parts. I had a trombone player who covered four parts. And then I had bass, piano, and drums. Recorded the whole thing in the studio.
Here's what Caro came up with.
St- Steve came into the studio. He heard it once. He said, that's the right one. And he wanted it to be the main title for the series. But Nickelodeon said, no, no, no. We want something that has lyrics and tells a backstory of the characters.
So they went with this instead.
Are y'all ready, kids?
Aye, aye, Captain!
I can't hear you!
Aye, aye, Captain!
Oh! Who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
If they had used that music as the main title theme, I wouldn't have to work for a living, you know. But that's okay.
Even though they didn't pick his theme, Carroll went on to write songs for the show, including the Jellyfish Jam, and he even wrote the music for the fun song. You know, the one that drove parents up the wall in the early aughts.
F is for friends who do stuff together. U is for you and me. N is for anywhere and anytime at all.
Down here in the deep blue sea.
But perhaps his biggest contribution to the SpongeBob universe is a mediocre jazz performance that has now become iconic.
Steve remembered that I played clarinet. He said, you play clarinet, don't you? I said, yeah. We said, you know, we have a character on SpongeBob who plays a clarinet. Would you be interested in covering that part? I said, sure. Well, that was about 23 years ago.
Squidward Tentacles lives next door to the childlike SpongeBob and his friend Patrick. Squidward laments their interruptions of his clarinet practice.
Squidward! 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 Squidward!
Every clarinet, all the clarinet I play, I'm improvising, right? So it's considered an original composition. So I am the owner of all that crappy clarinet playing that Squidward does.
Caro spent 30 years in the film industry, but one day he'd had enough. He decided he wanted to switch careers and become a therapist, something he had a little experience with as a taxi driver in L.A.
And people would get in my cab and just spill their guts to me and tell me everything about them because they never see me again. And that was when I realized that, hey, I'm a pretty good listener. So it was going back to that that really made me feel like, yeah, I think I could do this.
He's worked in the mental health field as a therapist for 10 years, and he's still able to have time for his creative pursuits like music. He still plays Squidward's clarinet when the SpongeBob showrunners need it for an episode. He's in an up-and-coming local sax quartet, and he has a show on Raven Radio, Groovin' Hard with Brad Caro. It's all about something he shares with his clarinet counterpart, Squidward, his love of jazz. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
I rock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
On June 11th, Alaska will have the first round of a special election to fill the open seat in Congress. Every Alaskan voter will receive a ballot in the mail. In the June 11th primary, you can only vote for one person. The ranking happens later. Pick your favorite candidate, sign, and get a friend to sign as well. Then mail it back. And remember that June 11th is the Pick One primary. This message sponsored by Alaskans for Better Elections.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.